Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning. Happy, happy Sunday for everybody. We're going to be talking about important environmental issues today, solar energy and uranium mining. Anybody, do we still have uranium out there? People sort of forget about that. Southern Environmental Law Center's Will Cleveland with us today. Good morning, Will.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. Will Cleveland, Middlebury College graduate, University of Virginia School of Law.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, I got some homework, correct? Uranium mining. It seems like, it makes me think of superheroes. People go digging for uranium mining because they want to be a superhero or a supervillain, I guess, in this case, because we don't want them to do that anymore.
We don't. In fact, there has been a law in Virginia since 1983 that expressly says you can't mine uranium in Virginia. And there have been attempts over the years by the folks who own a very large uranium deposit down in Pennsylvania County who want to overturn that mining ban. They tried to do it through the General Assembly a few years back, and they failed. And then over the last 2 years or so, they have been trying to get the law thrown out via two different lawsuits that they filed here in Virginia.
So let's talk about that for a little bit. Again, Will Cleveland here from the SELC, Southern Environmental Law Center, in Pennsylvania County. That's Pitts, P-I-T-T, not Penns, P-E-N-N, Pennsylvania County. You're talking about Coles Hill, correct?
That's correct.
Coles Hill Farm?
Yeah.
So tell the story. There's some big uranium cache down there?
There is down at the Coles Hill deposit what some have argued is the largest single deposit of uranium anywhere in the continental United States. The problem is that although it is very large, it is also incredibly low quality. And the act and process of digging all of that uranium up out of the ground and processing it and turning it into even remotely a usable fuel would have potentially devastating environmental consequences, not only in the Danville area, but also sort of throughout the watershed. And so back in the early 80s, the General Assembly commissioned a study and put together a work group to evaluate whether this was something that would be a good idea for Virginia to proceed with. And almost the universal conclusion was that no, it was not a good idea. So they passed a law outright banning it. And not long after that law went into effect, the Three Mile Island incident happened. And so the price of uranium fell through the floor, and nobody anywhere was interested in trying to get that uranium out of the ground. And then sort of in the early 2000s, the price of uranium had climbed back up a little bit, and the owners decided it might be worth spending some capital to try and get the law overturned. And fortunately, they were unsuccessful. They got up one General Assembly member to put a bill in, but then he withdrew that bill before it ever even came up for a single vote. So the General Assembly has not acted on this since 1983 because they haven't had to. And then not long after that happened, you had Fukushima. And so the price of uranium then went through the floor again. And at current prices, it's not even economical to mine, even at the most optimistic outlook in terms of how much uranium you can get and what the quality would be. It would be a losing endeavor. There would be no money to be made right now. Nevertheless, back in, I think, 2015, the owners of the property got together and they filed two different lawsuits, one in federal court in Danville and one down in Virginia State Court in Wise County, which, as you are aware, is nowhere near to Pennsylvania County or to Danville. But it is a very pro-mining part of the state, and they thought they could find themselves a more friendly forum down there than in Danville, where the community is almost universally opposed to allowing uranium mining to go forward.
Again, our guest today, Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center. We'll be talking about solar energy as well, but we're talking about uranium mining to start the hour. So, Will, as we talk about the Coles Hill Farm uranium deposit, uranium radioactive, right? So getting to it, getting to the deposit would require some sort of special mining, correct? Because otherwise, would it not make an environmental mess? Because there are rivers nearby.
There are rivers nearby, and it's a good point. So there are two different sort of, or there are three really aspects to uranium mining and processing. So the first step is to dig it up out of the ground, and the uranium itself is sort of embedded in all of this other indigenous rock and soil. So you have to process the uranium to get it refined. So it's called milling it. You basically grind it all up and then you sort it.
Right. It's not just a uranium rock surrounded by soil.
Right. So you have to remove the uranium from all of the other natural rock that's around. That's you mill it. You basically grind it up and then you sift it. And then there is a process of you take whatever the uranium you've managed to sift out of the process and you go and process that and turn it into a usable fuel. But then you've got all of this leftover residue waste rock, which is not radioactive in its own right, but it has been so exposed to uranium that it becomes radioactive. And so you've got all of these radioactive wastes that have to be stored somewhere, and those are called the tailings. And so the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission has very strict guidelines for how you mill the uranium and how you store the tailings. They do not, however, regulate how you actually go about mining the rock in the first place. That is left to the states. And that was actually one of the central issues in the lawsuit that they brought in federal court. The state law that Virginia passed back in 1983 expressly outlaws mining uranium. It doesn't talk about tailings. It doesn't talk about milling. Those are federal issues. But the mining itself is a state issue, and they have banned it. Because they have concluded that even if you were to follow all of the federal guidelines for how you go about milling the uranium and storing the tailings, there is still a serious hazard just from the act of mining it alone and releasing all of this radioactive stuff. And so the General Assembly, in their wisdom, 35, 36 years ago, decided we don't want it.
What about the people of Danville, of Pennsylvania County? Because we've found that not necessarily for uranium mining, but for other processes that bring jobs, whether you're talking about coal or fracking or other tasks, sometimes local areas want the job over the environmental concern. So how do the people of Pennsylvania County, the city of Danville, what is their stand on uranium mining?
Well, I wouldn't presume to speak for the entire county or the people of the city of Danville. We do represent certain groups that are active in those localities, and I think their position is almost purely economic. Obviously, they're concerned about the environmental impacts to the rivers and to the watersheds, but largely they are interested in a robust, diverse and sustainable economy for that part of the state. And if you look at the price of uranium over the last 30 or 40 years, it is anything but stable or sustainable. It skyrockets all over the map. And so if you were trying to build a sustainable and growing economy down in that part of the state, you want something that is dependable. And uranium is not that.
But there must be whether it's a board of supervisors or a city council, have they not come out and said, let this group come in and dig this up?
No, there's certainly been no vocal support in trying to overturn the law and trying to get a mining operation going down there. Certainly not a formal one. There may be certain people down there who are in favor. Certainly the owners of the property themselves are in favor of getting a mining operation going. But I think if you were to talk to the people who are primarily concerned with the economic health of that part of the state, they would tell you that a uranium mine is the last thing that they need.
But there's no governmental group No city council, no board of supervisors, nobody there has stood up and said, overturn this law, we're trying to overturn the law. Nobody there
has
done that at this point. 10 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Will Cleveland, Southern Environmental Law School, Law Center attorney, who went to the University of Virginia Law School.
I did.
SELC attorney Will Cleveland. We're talking about uranium mining to start the hour. You mentioned the organization trying to get this uranium mining law overturned. Tell us a little bit about that business.
Well, it's a business. So the Coles Hill property has belonged to the Coles family, and there is another family nearby that owns a separate parcel, and those two families have gotten together to form what is called Virginia Uranium Inc., VUI. And that company is trying to overturn this law so that they can begin a mining operation ostensibly for them to make money. Although with the price of uranium being what it currently is, there's no money to be made even if they had the right and the ability to go out and actually conduct mining operations. It would lose money right now, even if it happened.
But you said earlier that it's been sort of an up and down.
Mostly
value.
Down. It has fluctuated over the last 30 years, but between Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and Fukushima. And then you couple all of those issues with the fact that the nuclear units that are supposedly under construction in South Carolina and Georgia are on very, very tenuous footing. The future of nuclear as a fuel, purely from an economic standpoint, is in serious doubt. And so there are far better ways that you can invest in communities to have an economic growth than through a uranium mining operation.
What do we know? If there's no money to be made, do we know why this business, these two family groups, are still making the effort to get the law changed?
Well, I'm not sure that they would concede that there is no money to be made. If you look at all of the papers that they have filed and the various lawsuits that they've brought, they repeatedly claim that they're sitting on about $6 billion worth of uranium. That's a very optimistic forecast, but if I were sitting on what I thought could be valued at $6 billion, I might start to convince myself of the need to go out and get access to it myself. I, however, am not.
But they're right next to drinking water as well. And you stated a few minutes ago that the residuals, the tailings, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Correct word? Are likely to end up in the drinking water.
Well, it's certainly a very serious concern that they might. But even if the tailings don't, just the mere fact of mining the uranium is a serious problem as well.
Is there a way to keep the residuals from the drinking water? Or is this where SELC, is this why you, as an attorney at SELC, is involved in this uranium mining issue?
I mean, I think our position would be that the potential downsides so drastically outweigh the potential upside that it's not worth pursuing. That a real accident, either at the mining stage or with a tailings facility or even in a milling operation, could potentially damage the drinking water and this of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, all to conduct an operation that even right now wouldn't even break even. So why would we want that? Why wouldn't we much rather invest in that part of the state in a way that is sustainable and non-harmful to the environment, that draws a diverse economy rather than a boom and bust economy based upon one particular operation? And I think that's one of the problems that you have in southwestern Virginia that was so heavily dependent on coal, that when coal goes away, there's nothing left. You need a diverse economy, and a uranium mine would not provide that.
The drinking water goes from where? Danville? Is it in the Dan River, which has already been ruined?
Well, that's a coal ash problem, but yeah. A lot of coastal communities have been flows all the way down to the Chesapeake. So between everything from Southside Virginia to Tidewater, along that river shed could be adversely impacted.
But it's already been ruined.
Well, not with your radioactive waste, it hasn't.
I mean, obviously, I'm just playing a game here, but if it's already been ruined, then, you know, okay, go ahead, do your thing.
I don't think I would concede that the entire Dan River has been ruined, nor do I think that the residents of Danville would concede that. Certainly the spill, the coal ash spill that happened in February of 2014 was a massive environmental problem for the Dan River, but it hasn't ruined the entire river. But it is a problem. And I think that's just one more example of why we need to be very vigorous in defending our watersheds because of exactly that kind of problem.
And it goes to Lake Gaston.
I think that's right. I haven't looked at a map in a while.
Again, our guest today, Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center, as we talk about uranium mining. My understanding or my notes show there were 16 lobbyists at one point registered trying to get the uranium mining law overturned. That's a lot of work to get this law overturned. But I guess $6 billion is a lot of money.
$6 billion is a lot of money. Again, that's a very optimistic calculation of how much that stuff is worth. I haven't looked recently. I'd be amazed if they still had 16 lobbyists on retainer. There's been no effort to overturn the ban at the General Assembly during Governor McAuliffe's administration because he publicly pledged that he would veto any law that passed the General Assembly overturning the ban. So they kind of gave up on the General Assembly. And I think one thing to watch out for is what happens under the next governor. Is the next governor going to have a similar pledge to veto any ban or any attempt to overturn the ban? Because if you don't have a governor in the Manchin who's willing to veto such a law, then you might see a legislative push in the 2018 or 2019 General Assembly session. This is a problem that requires constant vigilance on many fronts.
Didn't we see something that we're talking about, the Coles Hill Farm deposit? Didn't we see something similar to this, maybe not to this extent of the deposit, but wasn't there a uranium deposit in Orange County?
You know, that all happened sort of before I joined SELC, so everything I have is anecdotal, but what I have heard is that there is some uranium in Orange County, but that the property owners there recognized that it was not something that was in any way good for them or for the economy, and they've just not had any interest in mining it or challenging the ban.
And the federal appeals court was divided on the issue.
Well, so a little bit of background. So they filed a lawsuit in federal court in Danville, and the attorney general's office filed a motion to ask the court to throw the lawsuit out, basically saying that it was a meritless claim, that even if you assumed all of the facts that were true, it was still not a legitimate lawsuit. And the court agreed, correctly so, I think. The property owners who want to mine the uranium appealed that dismissal to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, which heard that appeal with a 3-judge panel, and in a 2-to-1 decision affirmed the trial judge's decision to throw the lawsuit out. I think they also were correct in affirming that. And then the property owners have now asked the United States Supreme Court to take up the case. The Supreme Court has not yet ruled on whether they will. But this case has at least made it as far as a request to the United States Supreme Court. That's just the federal case. The state case hasn't even gone to trial yet.
What was the one judge? What was his or her decision based on?
So the issue was whether the Federal Atomic Energy Act precluded the state of Virginia from having its own laws about uranium mining. And the trial judge in Danville concluded that there was no problem, that the state had its absolute authority to regulate mining however it saw fit, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not regulate mining. The two judges from the Fourth Circuit agreed with that. The third judge said it was too soon to tell, that you needed to actually have a more robust evaluation of the record.
20 minutes after the hour with our guest, Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Take a break. We'll be right back and finish up discussion on uranium mining. And here we are back on Sunday morning. And that's why we're called the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Thanks for being with us today. And thanks to Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center, a product of Middlebury College, University of Virginia School of Law, Will Cleveland, as we discuss uranium mining. So the most current update on this is sort of we're sitting, waiting to see if the U.S. Supreme Court takes this any further.
For the federal lawsuit, that's correct. The property owners have asked the United States Supreme Court to evaluate whether they have the right to move forward. The United States Supreme Court has asked the Attorney General's office to respond to the petition. That response is, I think, due on August 2nd. And so we'll see what the Supreme Court does after that.
And otherwise, in the state of Virginia rules, leave it alone. Staying where it is. Sorry, Virginia Uranium Incorporated. You can't touch that.
Certainly right now, there has been no change to the law. We'll see what happens with the lawsuit that they filed down in Wise County, which could potentially have negative impacts for those who oppose uranium mining as well. That trial was originally supposed to happen next month in August, but I actually just found out yesterday that it's going to get moved, although I don't know to what date.
All right. And for those of you who are wondering about next month, that's because we're pre-recording this show in July, and we'll play the show in the next week or so. Again, Will Cleveland here from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Well, as we talk about Southern Environmental Law Center, how big is the SELC?
Well, we have offices, legal offices in six states throughout the Southeast and in Washington, D.C. So Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee. And we've got, I think I heard recently that as of right now, we have the second largest legal team of any nonprofit in the United States.
Second?
That's what
largest?
I heard recently. Yeah, just in terms of counting numbers of lawyers for a nonprofit, I heard we had the second largest.
Good grief.
Which shocked me, but it's a pretty big organization.
What kind of projects are you guys working on, guys and women?
We work on various projects that are all very state-specific. So part of our central mission is to focus on a very state and local-based issues. So each state has its own issues, and the lawyers in those states respond to those issues. Here in Virginia, I focus almost exclusively on Virginia energy policy. So trying to push policies that will reduce our greenhouse gas emissions so that we can reduce the impacts of climate change, trying to oppose uranium mining, which we just talked about, trying to push policies that will allow more people who want to put solar on their roofs to be able to do that. At the same time, opposing any new fossil fuel-fired power plants, because those are just going to exacerbate the already serious problems of climate change. But we also have people who work on hydraulic fracturing. Offshore drilling is a big issue right now under the new administration. A lot of water issues. We have a coal ash team that has dealt with coal ash throughout our states. So it very much depends on where you are, what we're working on.
So you're a big stockholder in Dominion Power.
I don't believe I own any Dominion Power stock.
No. So again, Will Cleveland here from Southern Environmental Law Center. So solar energy, a big project for you in numerous ways.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about solar energy again, 25 minutes after the hour here on Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Solar energy as a grand topic. I don't understand, and I need you to take a step back from your personal involvement with it. I don't understand why it isn't more popular. I understand why you're involved with it. I understand why I don't get... Doesn't make sense to me why everybody wants to go, let's go coal. It's a At some point, we're going to run out of coal. I don't understand why people don't want solar power. Why can't we get involved with solar and wind turbines? But well, why isn't solar more popular?
When you say popular, are you talking about from a utility point of view, or are you talking about popular from sort of your average residential customer point of view?
If you walked down the street with a microphone and asked people on the street about solar versus coal versus gasoline in their tank versus fracture, it seems like solar power is not that high on the list.
I don't know that I would agree with you. I think if you were to walk down the street with a microphone and ask people if they could choose any resource to power their homes or their cars, if it were solar or natural gas or coal, I think most people would tell you they'd choose solar. I think the problem is that most people don't realize just how cheap solar has become. I think that there is a misperception among a lot of people that solar is sort of a luxury item that most people can't afford. And that is almost by the day becoming less and less true. So every year, the utilities here in Virginia have to file a 15-year planning document with the State Corporation Commission. It's called an Integrated Resource Plan. And it basically lays out how the utilities are going to plan to meet all of the demands placed upon them over the next 15 years. In the 2017 Integrated Resource Plan that Dominion Energy filed in May of this year, so May of 2017, they expressly said that solar had dropped, I think, 24% in price just from the previous year. So in a one-year period, the price of solar dropped 25%. It continues to do that and just falling through the floor. Solar is getting so cheap that when utilities are looking at long-term planning for resources without any subsidies and without any carbon regulations putting their thumb on the lever, solar is becoming basically the cheapest resource you can find.
And what causes that?
I think it's just...
I mean, the sun isn't getting any less expensive.
I think it's a function of just market economics and scale, that the people who are out there developing these solar panels are just doing it far more efficiently and at far lower cost, and so they're able to produce them and sell them at lower cost. The technology itself, as I understand it, and I am not an engineer, I'm not a technician, but as I understand it, the technology hasn't changed. It's just that it's gotten cheaper to produce.
Again, our guest, Will Cleveland, Southern Environmental Law Center, as we talk about solar energy. Would you say that solar energy is vastly underutilized?
I would. I would definitely say that. And I do say that quite frequently, in fact.
Is that the public that's doing that? Is that, if you do say that, what's the reason?
Well, solar can play a lot of different roles. And one of the real benefits of a resource like solar is that it is scalable. That, you know, unlike a nuclear plant or a coal-fired power plant or a natural gas power plant, which you have to build up to a certain size before it makes any kind of economic sense, you can have a one single solar panel on a garage, or you can have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them to create something that is of an equivalent size to a coal-fired power plant. That you can scale those, and it's still cost-effective at almost any scale. But the people who deploy them at those different scales are very different. So the utilities are the ones who are buying solar panels in the 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 megawatt size, which is sort of starting to approach the size of historical power plant sizes. But you can also get a 5 kilowatt, which is just a hundredth of the size, and put it on your roof. The economics of those endeavors are obviously a little bit different because, again, you've got a supply and demand and a cost issues there. But as we are seeing, the utilities more and more are starting to recognize that solar is not only a resource that they can't ignore from a policy perspective, it's a resource that they can't ignore from an economic perspective. And so you have entities like Dominion who are expressly acknowledging that it is the lowest cost resource and it will play a central role in all utility scale planning going forward.
Solar energy only, it's not the best word choice, but solar energy, if I live in Florida, if I live in Virginia, if I live in Maine, you know, better for me to live in one state versus the other to use it? Am I going to have to shut it down in January? If I live in Maine, and so it's only good for 6 months or 9 months out of the year because the other months can't satisfy my 24-hour-a-day needs?
No. In fact, I learned this not too long ago. And again, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. But
you can play one on the radio.
I play one in court. The issue with solar tends not to be temperature. The issue is more cloud cover. So the more sunny days you have, the more effective solar is going to be. But in fact, barring truly extreme weather conditions, solar is actually performs better in colder temperature than it does in hot, which I didn't realize until very recently. So no, solar can be very effective in places like Maine. It's just a question of how many cloudy days do you have a year.
And when you're learning this in court or preparing for court, have you learned that there are regions of the country where Dominion would rather not be because of these cloudy days? So it shouldn't be in Portland, Oregon, where solar energy wouldn't work because of all their rainy days?
I focus pretty much exclusively on Virginia, but solar is very useful across the country. It's solar and wind, so you have to sort of take advantages of whatever local geography and climate allows. So sort of in the Midwest, you're seeing wind being the really massively growing renewable resource. In the Southeast and the Southwest, it's solar. And there's always energy efficiency to go along with all of that. And by energy efficiency, I mean far more efficient technologies, products, appliances that consume far less energy to provide the same services. And so as we upgrade all of our appliances and our light bulbs and do a better job of insulating our homes and our buildings, the total electricity consumption can go down, and that can generate a lot of savings as well.
32 minutes after the hour with our guest, Will Cleveland, talking about solar energy. Will's from Southern Environmental Law Center. So we're talking about solar energy. You brought in wind turbines. One of the issues with the turbines are that the public, not strictly the public, but the public says, I don't want a wind turbine there because it's not aesthetically pleasing, or the sound bothers me. Have you found that something similar is brought up because of the solar panels?
I have heard anecdotally there are concerns about that, but I think if you actually talk to the people who live in and around solar installations, you would find that there's not much opposition at all. They don't really make noise.
Isn't there something, and this just popped into my head. I have nothing but something popped into my head. Wasn't there some story about some place in the Northeast about the solar panels? And you're looking at me like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
There may have been. I'm not sure what you're talking about, but it's possible that somebody in the Northeast...
Somebody complained about a neighborhood or an area or something they didn't like about an area that wanted to put in all solar panels for their neighborhood or their... Anyway, all right. Somebody's welcome to help me with that story. All right. So let's talk about the General Assembly. How helpful or harmful, or both sides of that, has the General Assembly been either in 2017 or in years past with solar energy?
So that is actually one of the things that gives me great comfort for the future of humanity, particularly under the current administration, that while things seem to be breaking down at the federal level in terms of clean energy policy and in terms of environmental protection, in the 2017 General Assembly session, there were some very good pro-solar bills introduced by Republicans and that I helped write and that I helped get passed. So people who actually engage at the state level and recognize that solar is a largely untapped and underutilized job-creating resource for Virginia are starting to push policies that will grow the amount of solar that we have here, thus growing the number of jobs that we have here, thus growing the general overall economy.
So let's see if these are some of the ones that I noted, although from SP 1395, do you remember any of them? I wrote these down, but I wrote them down a while ago. From Wagner, increases 100 megawatts to 150 megawatts, the size of solar or wind projects eligible to use the state's permit by rule process.
Mm-hmm. That's one of them.
So what would that? What does that do? You have to help explain these things and why they're helpful.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So also, I will tell you that if you're going to just recite the bill numbers, I'm probably going to give you a blank stare. I'm not great at remembering the specific numbers of the bills. But that is the permit by rule bill, and the idea is to streamline the environmental permitting process for renewable energy projects like solar and wind. It's purely an effort to make it easier to get those projects approved and permitted, and then therefore built and putting clean renewable energy onto our grid.
But what is it? I mean, if I'm a homeowner, what is it? I mean, why do I even need this?
Well, that isn't necessarily for homeowners. Like I was saying, that solar, and to a lesser extent wind, but mostly solar, is scalable. So you have some projects which are targeted at utility-level energy procurement, and then you have some projects which are targeted at residential rooftop procurement. This is more targeted at sort of the utility scale. It's designed to make it easier for renewable solar and wind developers to get their projects built and therefore acquired by the utilities to put utility scale generation onto the grid. But because it makes it easier and more streamlined, it lowers the cost, therefore lowering the cost for energy acquisition for the utilities, hopefully passing those cost savings on to us as residential customers.
All right, here's a bill by Sullivan. Which would have required electric utilities to meet efficiency goals. And another by Sullivan, which would have changed how the SCC evaluates energy efficiency programs and killed off, but that was killed off in the House Energy Subcommittee.
Yeah, so those are not the bills that passed, which are the ones I was talking about. I was talking about there were three Wagner bills that were introduced and passed, and then there was a companion Kilgore bill on the House side.
Let's see. The community solar bill.
Yeah, that's the one I helped write.
Okay, tell us about that. Designed to launch a utility-controlled and administered solar option for customers.
Yes. So this is a bill that was a product of a negotiation between the solar industry developers, their trade association here in Virginia, and the utilities. And they had been trying to come up with some compromise legislation that they could introduce that would have sort of unanimous support from people on all sides of the issue. And around October, November of last year, they came to me and said, hey, we want to involve the environmental community. Would you help us work out some of the kinks in this bill? And so this bill is designed to expand the access to solar for customers. Because the reality of solar is that even if you can afford it, and it's getting cheaper every day, but even if you can afford it, not every home can have solar on it because of shade or the way it faces the sun, or not everybody lives in their own home. Some people live in residential multi-family dwellings, like apartment buildings. Some people don't own their houses at all. They just rent. So not everybody who might be interested in going solar can. The idea behind this bill is to basically allow you to share in the solar output of some solar facility that is not located on your roof. And the solar developers, this has all been sort of historically called community solar, so that sort of the community bands together and builds a solar farm, and then everybody shares in the output. The problem with that historic model is that it is very difficult for the solar developers to get financing to build it, because they have to go out and find several hundred or several thousand individual customers who want to share the slice of the pie. And there's always the possibility that those people might move, and then they are left sort of scrambling to cover their costs. This bill that I worked on would streamline a lot of these issues. So it allows Dominion or Appalachian Power to sign one long-term contract with the solar developer for 100% of the output from this small solar facility. The utilities then turn around and sell subscriptions to that solar facility to their pre-existing customer base. And there are some specific protections that we put into the bill that are supposed to help customers. One of which is that if you sign up, you get billed for your solar share first, and then only if you have any surplus consumption beyond what you have taken off of the solar facility do you get billed for your normal power. Another is that it's portable. If you sign up and then move within that utility service territory, as long as you notify them, you can take it with you. Another is that there is a certain economic benefit to doing so. If you sign up in year one, the rate you pay for that solar output will be capped. It won't go up. So as general residential rates continue to climb, you are protected because as long as you're in the program, you're only paying that initial capped rate. So if you sign up, there's no upfront cost. There's no long-term commitment. But as long as you're in the program, you get the benefit of that capped rate. And that's what gets billed to you first. And we were only able to do that because the utilities are playing the middleman and taking off all of the power. Does that make sense?
It does, and it's fascinating because I have to take a break, but I want to come back and talk a little bit more about that because I want to know, because I've heard throughout and reading about this, about how Dominion and others sort of fight a lot about this, I guess because they can't make a profit. Anyway, I want to talk more about Dominion as well. So we'll be right back. Southern Environmental Law Center attorney Will Cleveland talking about solar power. Hang tight. And Sunday morning wake-up call here, talking about solar energy with Will Cleveland from the SELC. And no beeping in case we get dirty words here, talking about Dominion Power as we talk about solar energy and Dominion Power's thoughts on solar energy with Will Cleveland. So, Will, we were talking about the community solar bill and how Dominion Power could, I guess, finally sort of make that work. Were they forced into that in any way? Because years past, at least when I did a show years ago on solar power, and it was, I guess, the way I was led to believe was Dominion didn't want anything to do with that because they couldn't make profit off of solar power. That was just taking another customer out of their client base. So your thoughts on that, please.
Well, so this community solar bill is a little bit unique, and I think that's one of the benefits of sort of creative compromise. The people who participate in this community solar program are going to still remain Dominion customers. They're not going off to somebody else and getting solar power. So they are still buying all of their power through Dominion. So Dominion isn't losing its customer base in any way as a product of this community solar bill. The other thing to keep in mind is, as I said earlier, the prices of solar are falling dramatically year by year, month by month, almost day by day. So Dominion's position on solar 5 years ago is basically irrelevant to asking what Dominion's position on solar is today because the economics have changed so dramatically. And Dominion is a very large entity, and you can't turn that entity on a dime, but there are definitely smart, motivated people at Dominion who are interested and dedicated to growing the amount of solar in Virginia and doing it in a way that is creative. And those are the people that I've been working with on things like this community solar bill.
Do you think that there's a way for Dominion Power to one day become Dominion Solar Power?
I certainly would love to see that. I mean, we engage with Dominion on a lot of fronts. Sometimes it's friendly, sometimes it's not so friendly, depending on the topic. But when it comes to the future of Dominion's energy fleet, I would like to see a world in which basically from here on out, the only thing they're investing in is solar, wind, and storage and efficiency. I think that they have just come off a big rash of building a bunch of natural gas-fired power plants. I think they've got enough of that. I think it's time for them to start thinking about what the future energy mix should look like, and it should look like a bunch of solar, which they are doing a much better job of than they even did a year or two ago. Wind, which they're doing a better job of. They just announced that they are finally moving forward with their 12-megawatt offshore wind demonstration project. So that's good. Efficiency is a stickier thing. And then storage is also a thing that we had a bill passed just this year that will hopefully expand the amount of storage that we have here in Virginia. So I think that there is a way forward for Dominion to be the company you just described. It won't be easy, though.
Let's go back to some of the 2017 Virginia legislature. If I can find some of my notes here. Virginia's Solar Energy Development Authority until 2025. Does that bring up anything for you?
That's not one of the bills I worked on because I'm not on the Development Authority.
UVA and Dominion have a solar partnership for King William County.
Yeah, Dominion is inch by inch, minute by minute, getting better about solar. They are bringing more solar onto the grid.
What does that entail, though? Are you aware of, you know, what does having a partnership for King William County do?
Well, it puts new solar panels in the ground, and it puts more solar energy onto the grid.
Is that sort of working with the government there? Is that what that is?
Yeah, I mean, some of the details of that are, I think, confidential because it's a government contract. But basically, Dominion, in addition to generally building more solar, has gone out and signed these sort of, what they're calling them, ring-fenced projects. Basically, Dominion is going out and building or buying large solar facilities where a specific customer will receive all of the energy from that. And as a result, Dominion is not passing on the costs of those projects to its general customer base. It's just that one particular customer is shouldering all of the cost. So you've got things like the 80-megawatt facility in Accomack County that Amazon has. Nobody's paying for that but Amazon, and there are others like that.
I see another one here that says there's a bill that would have changed how the SEC evaluates energy efficiency programs, but that was killed off in the House Energy Subcommittee.
Yeah.
You held your head and sort of shaking it like, oh, my God, why would anybody do that?
No, energy efficiency is a tricky thing in Virginia, and we don't have nearly as much of it as we should. As I said before, when I say energy efficiency, what I mean is basically updating and upgrading technology to more energy-efficient things like refrigerators. And these are just examples, dishwashers, washer-dryers, light bulbs. And in many other states, we have, and to a certain extent here in Virginia, we have energy efficiency programs that are administered and sponsored by the utilities. So in some of these programs, what Dominion does is they will effectively offer a rebate to their customers to upgrade certain appliances in their homes. And Dominion covers part of the cost of that upgrade. The idea being that in putting in the new, more energy efficient heat pump to replace an old outdated furnace, that house will consume less electricity. And therefore, not only will the homeowner save some money on their bills, but Dominion will have to generate less electricity to meet its overall customer demand because a lot of these houses have lower consumption profiles. And then what Dominion does is they spread the cost of these programs across their customers. But they can only do that if the State Corporation Commission has approved the program. And although in other states, like from Arkansas to Massachusetts, you have very robust energy efficiency portfolios that the utilities put out there that have radically reduced the electricity consumption within those states and saved a lot of people a lot of money, to date, we just have not had a lot of success at getting these programs approved, and therefore we are trailing behind almost the entire country in the amount of energy we save through these energy efficiency programs. And that bill that you just mentioned was designed, I think, to change the manner in which the State Corporation Commission evaluates the programs in the hopes that more programs would get approved.
You mentioned efficient dishwashers, efficient refrigerators. Is that yellow sticker saying that you're buying an efficient appliance, does that mean anything anymore?
The Energy Star sticker?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very important thing. It's hard to appreciate how small things, savings like that from one dishwasher to another, when they build up over time in the aggregate, can really drive down the amount of electricity that gets consumed. So yeah, that stuff's important.
Okay. Again, our guest, Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center, talking about solar power. Earlier in the show, uranium mining. If you listen to the podcast, CVillePodcast.com, you can go back and check that out. How about retiring outdated coal-burning plants? What has that got to do with speeding up our solar needs?
Well, I'm certainly a big fan of retiring the really old, outdated coal plants that are very dirty. In terms of our solar needs, the more fossil-fired generation that goes away, and the more we can replace it with solar, the better, certainly is my opinion.
But is it happening? Is it going to happen? Is it all talk?
You know,
yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to put, we'll retire that in 2022, but then when 2021 gets here, we can't actually do that.
So I generally speaking, I don't think the utilities think of it as we are going to retire this plant and replace it with that plant. They sort of retire stuff as it needs to be retired due to life expectancy, costs of coal, costs of complying with various environmental regulations. And then over time, they look at where their generation fleet is, and if they're going to build something new, they look at what the lowest cost thing to build is. Fortunately, that more and more proves to be solar. And so I think as we continue to go through this process and as the regulatory proceeding that Governor McAuliffe has initiated to cap carbon here in Virginia, as that moves along, you're only going to see the thumb press further down on the scale of things like solar and wind to take the place of any old, outdated coal-fired power plants. So as things roll off, the things that roll on should be solar and wind.
Is that going to change? let me phrase this properly. You mentioned Governor McAuliffe. Is there expectation or concern that the next governor may play a role in helping or hindering that? Or is it done at the legislative level?
It is not done at the legislative level. It's done through the executive. And I think there's no world in which the next governor doesn't carry it across the line if it happens at all. So the current plan is for the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality to begin writing a regulation, which they will then present in draft form to the State Air Pollution Control Board in December of this year, December 2017. The Air Board will vote on that proposed regulation and put it out for public notice and comment sometime in 2018. By that time, we will have a new governor. And so whether the Air Board finalizes that regulation and it goes into effect will largely depend on the next governor, which is why it's important, listeners, for you to call whoever you're voting for in the gubernatorial election and say that a state program to reduce carbon is in everybody's best interests. It should be something that both gubernatorial candidates support. But the Southern Environmental Law Center is not a political organization. We don't endorse candidates. We don't get involved in that level. But it's certainly something that we value and think should be a new regulation.
When we're talking about solar energy here during the last two segments of the program, again, this is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WPVC 94.7. With Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center. We've been talking a lot about the state level. But when we talk about solar panels, are there different laws and regulations in the city versus the county? So for our listeners, it's Charlottesville versus Albemarle. But if you're listening on the podcast, you certainly could be listening in Richmond versus Hopewell versus you know, Lynchburg versus anywhere else in the state? Do you have to be concerned about whether or not you could put up one versus two versus 10 on your roof, in your yard, et cetera?
Well, so there are different restrictions depending on who your utility is. So the law that allows customers to put solar on their roofs, there's a certain amount of solar that can go in any particular service utility service territory. So if you live in Appalachian Power's territory, that bucket is bigger or smaller than it is in Dominion's territory. So it depends on where you live, just upon who your utility is. In addition to that, there's always the potential that local land use and zoning and other sort of city or municipal or county level issues could be an obstruction. Yes.
Architectural review board.
Sure, that could be a problem. I haven't heard a lot of stories about it being a problem, but it's always a possibility.
Is there any concern about federal issues, especially now that with our new presidential administration, that there's an EPA? Would the solar energy have any concern under Mr. Pruitt and the EPA?
Sure. You know, EPA stands for Environmental Protection Agency. I don't know under the new director how much protection is actually happening. You might have to think of a different word for P to stand for in EPA. Absolutely. The
show we did earlier today where P was anatomical.
I wasn't going there. So there was back in 2014 under President Obama, EPA proposed the Federal Clean Power Plan, which was the first nationwide effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the energy sector. Under the Trump administration, they have all but killed that, announcing their intention to roll it back. It has never gone into effect. I think it's very unlikely that anything of even remotely similar stringency would ever come out of the Trump administration and his EPA, which is why people like Governor McAuliffe and governors in, I think, 12 or 13 other states have banded together to say, regardless of what happens in Washington, D.C., we are going to move the ball forward on addressing climate change. We are going to take responsibility for meeting our obligations under the Paris Climate Accord, regardless of what happens in D.C. So it's frustrating, the total abdication of leadership in Washington on this issue. It's just a failure of global proportions, but there are others at the state levels who are trying to lead on this.
As an individual not representing the SCLC, have you done any marching? Have you been to D.C.? Do you have plans to do anything of this sort in representation of solar energy? Or
I have not. I think that work is very vital. I think the people who do that are to be commended. I'm usually too busy being stuck in Richmond actually in court on these issues. I think it takes both kinds. But I view my best and highest use as being a lawyer and being in the courtroom on this stuff.
Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate your work. All right, boys and girls, keep listening. 94.7 WPVC. See you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.